And it's only by the grace of God and the people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself that I'm here this morning. I want to thank the committee for inviting me, especially Barbara, and all the rest of you gals who stood up, and my chauffeur over there who carted me around and hounded me to death. And I especially want to welcome those new people that stood up last night. And I wonder if that little gal is here that had one day of sobriety yesterday. I would not be surprised if she went out and got drunk after that. Anyway, I was invited to talk about my drinking. And I can wrap up my whole drinking career by quoting what the cat said when he got through making love to the skunk. He said, "I didn't get all I wanted, but I got all I could stand." Now, I was born in Spain, and I came to this country when I was 3 years old, and we moved into a WASP neighborhood where they hated Catholics and foreigners. And so right from the beginning, you can see I felt unwanted and put upon. And I hated where I was and who I was because I wanted to be an American. And I knew that right from the very beginning, I knew what I wanted to be the rest of my life. I wanted to be the greatest dancer that ever lived. And I loved to dance, and I danced all the time. My father saw to it that I got dancing lessons, I got ballet lessons and acrobatic and tap and all those things, and I was dancing professionally at a very early age. And my mother and I weren't getting along, so the day after I graduated from high school, I was 16 years old, and I went on what is now known as the tail end of vaudeville. We used to travel around in caravans and cars, and it was during one of these caravan trips that someone passed around a bottle of slow gin. Now, when I mention slow gin, I know I'm dating myself because that isn't really the end drink these days. But as a matter of fact, I've been thinking about getting a facelift, you know. It's very popular in our area. I mean, what's the point in getting a facelift when everything else is sagging? I tell you, it's a sad day when you're trying on one of those cross-your-knees bras. I don't know what you're laughing about. She's got the kind you can scratch a match on, and she's sitting there laughing. When you get here, honey? Just wait till you get here, honey. Anyway, I'm here to talk about my drinking, I guess. Anyway, you know, I never was able to accurately predict my conduct like the book says. I just drank as much as I could, threw up, and passed out, and I set a pattern for my whole drinking career. Anyway, after this trip, I eventually wound up in the nightclubs of San Francisco, and now I really had it made there because, see, I was wearing those fancy clothes that feature dancers wear, and I was drinking. I mean, the booze was always available to me. I was table hopping, giving everybody a break, you understand. And I was written up in the columns. You know, Herb Cain used to call me the Belle of Bush Street. And, God, you know, I was walking around there like the queen bee, and yet inside I felt there was something terribly missing in my life. I felt unfulfilled. And then I knew, I finally found out what it was that made me feel unfulfilled. It was the fact that Hollywood hadn't discovered me yet and made me the big star that I knew I was going to be. And so I endured that kind of pain for a while, until I actually was invited to go take a screen test in Los Angeles. And so I went down to Hollywood with the attitude that Betty Davis had better start saving her money because I was on my way. And I had the type of arrogance that I'm sure some of you are familiar with. And so I went down there and I took the screen test, and it was rotten. Well, how can you act when you're already acting? But I didn't know that. I was signed to a stock contract, however, and that means that you're signed to a stock contract, and they put you out on the lot with the rest of the herd, and, you know, sometimes you're never heard of again. However, I did I did do some bit parts, and I did some dancing and so forth, but what I mostly did was I got caught up with the drinking crowd. Does that surprise you? I got caught up with the drinking crowd, you know, and I made all the nightclubs, the Sunset Boulevard, you know, those places that you read about in movie magazines, you know, Ciro's, Macombo, all those places. And I was a party girl. I loved that. I loved that life. I just thought it was wonderful, and I kept at it. And, you know, one thing I didn't realize was the reason I wasn't doing so well was because in that business, you have to have the soul of a butterfly and the skin of a rhinoceros. And, you know, I'm sensitive. And so, you know, I don't have that skin of a rhinoceros. I had to pretend that I did all the time. I did have the soul of a butterfly. I still do, as a matter of fact. But anyway, I was a party girl. And toward the end of the second year of that contract, I started getting a little concerned because I wasn't asked to do very much. And except that I was out there drinking, partying it up all the time. The thing with me was that I, you know, I drank with the right people, but I slept with the wrong ones. But toward the end of the second year, I was saved from a fate worse than death. A guy from the USO office in Beverly Hills came on the lot and offered me an opportunity to go overseas and entertain the soldiers because the World War II was on at the time. And I jumped at that chance because the first thing I thought of was all those men over there. You understand that, don't you? You women understand that. Anyway, I went overseas, and needless to say, I got into a lot of trouble over there. Like I said, I couldn't accurately predict my conduct ever. And so this trip took us to China, Burma, India. And if there's anyone here, any of you old graybeards that resent USO girls for fraternizing only with the officers, I'm here to remove your resentment. Because I drank with Yardbirds, generals. It didn't make any difference to me. Just said, where and let's go. So anyway, we were in the Himalaya Mountains someplace, and I remember drinking grapefruit juice and something with the guys the night before, and I came to the next morning, and I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. I found out since that it was some kind of denatured alcohol or whatever. Who cared, you know? Anyway, I was paralyzed. I could not move, and my roommate, who was a big star, ran over to the medics, and they came trooping over, and they gave me shots and oxygen and everything just to get me on my feet and functioning again. They worked on me for about 2 hours. And you know, I blamed the altitude. I just knew that I didn't even drink in Denver after that. I wouldn't drink here at all, for God's sake. I had my, well, you know, you have to defend your right to drink. So anyway, that was that. And so I came back from that tour very put upon. I felt very put upon because the military had not told us that they wanted us to entertain between shows. Well, actually, that demand didn't come from them at all. It came from me because I was one of those people who desperately needed your approval, and I couldn't say no to anything. I had to have your approval at any cost. And one of the great freedoms I've found here is the fact that I'm able today to live in a manner that's acceptable to me, regardless of public opinion. Because, you know, as long as I was dancing to your tune or saying what I thought you wanted me to say, I was throwing away my own approval, and that's the one I need the most. But anyway, I was now offered the opportunity to go overseas to the European theater. And so I thought to myself, this time it's going to be different. This time I'm not going to drink so much, and I'm not going to go to so many parties. And this time I'm not going to let everything go by me in a big gray haze. And this time I'm going to mind my P's and Q's. And this time, you've read my story in the big book. It's chapter 3, you know. This time it was different. It was worse. Because I really didn't know how not to get caught up in the same thing again. So you're looking at maybe the only girl that was up for court-martial. I don't know of any others that were, because, see, I was always madly in love, either that or recovering from love, and I don't know which I enjoyed the most, to tell you the truth. You know, when you're recovering from love, you turn on that sad music and you get the jug out, and you play the music and cry. You ever do that? I used to love the man who got away. That was my favorite. the man who got away. I'd get that jug out and start crying, and I loved the bittersweet agony that went with it. The other song that I loved was, "Is That All There Is?" That's the one. That really got me, just tear-jerking like mad. But anyway, I fell in love with this handsome lieutenant over there in Germany, and here I found myself several towns beyond where I first met him, and I suddenly, at a drinking party, naturally, and I suddenly decided, you know how you do, you suddenly decide, I suddenly decided I needed to get in touch with this man by telephone. So I went over and got on the field telephone, which means a field telephone, you go through relays, and it takes a while to make a connection. And so I got on the phone and just about got through when this captain, who was also drinking, came over and asked me to go drink or play or whatever. And I very dramatically, of course I was always dramatic, I very dramatically said that I am waiting for the voice of my beloved on the other end of the line. And he took his thumb and disconnected the phone. And I said to him, "Captain, if you do that once more, I'm going to hit you." And you know, he didn't believe me, because I just about got through again, and he did it again. And since I had the phone right here in my hand, I whacked him on the ear. And I like to say I didn't mean to hit him quite that hard, I don't think. But anyway, he was rather stunned, or whatever it was. He was drunk. And when he saw the blood gushing out of his ear and down his white trench coat, he screamed like a banshee and ran across the street to where the MPs were hosteled and signed this complaint against me. And, of course, they came trooping over, and he pointed me out. That's humiliating, you know that? He pointed me out, and I was ordered to appear the next morning for this hearing at 10 o'clock. God, you know. I spent the rest of the night trying to figure out how I was going to get out of this one. You ever do that? So I figured that since there were 14 girls on this show, that, you know, there was an outside chance that if I took two girls with me, you got to be clever, you know, two girls with me that sort of resembled me, that I'm just counting on the fact that he was so loaded he wouldn't be able to identify me. And so we showed up the next morning, and he was, this captain was sitting there. I mean, he had a hangover that was coming over in waves. I mean, you could feel it. You could feel it across the room. He had these poached eyes and red face, you know. And I felt sorry for him for about a second there. And then, you know, he just kept looking back and forth and back and forth, and he couldn't identify me. And I always tell this story because I have this dream. I have this fabulous dream that in looking back, I'm almost certain that he was one of us. Don't get ahead of me. I've got to tell you this story. And, you know, one day, I'm quite sure that I'm going to be standing at the podium. Of course, I know that he found his way to the fellowship. And this man is going to be in the audience. It might even be this morning. And when I'm through talking, he's going to come up to me with his hand extended and say, "Mary, I'm the captain that you hit on the ear in Germany. And I'm going to let him make his amends to me." We weren't always wrong, you know. Even a clock to stop is right twice a day. Now, I don't know any more than you do. I don't know any more than you do when it happened that everything went blank, that they turned the lights out all over the world. I don't know. I know that I was restless, irritable, and discontented, and I couldn't understand why, because the booze was not working, nothing was working, and I was sad, sad, sad. I was so depressed, but I blamed everything onto the war and the destruction I had seen and the things that I had gone out to the camps, and I had seen such terrible, terrible things. Man's inhumanity to man. And I just knew that the world was never going to be the same again. And I tried to drink it back, and I just kept drinking anyway, and it wasn't working. It absolutely wasn't working. And I made a decision that the only place I ever had any fun was in the San Francisco nightclubs. And so that's where I headed as soon as I got back. And, you know, I went back there, and They all seem to have changed. All my drinking buddies, all my friends, even the place itself, even the town itself seemed to have changed. And I was just in that desolate, desolate place that we find ourselves in sometimes. And I thought to myself, there's only one enemy. I've been all over the world. I've done everything. Just to settle down and get in there. I was careful as a victim to be a bartender. Now, any Al-Anon in this place will tell you, Katrina will tell you, that every pot goes out and finds a lid that fits it. This guy didn't drink. And I didn't hang around people that didn't drink, but we fit because he was a compulsive gambler. Now, I'll give you a clue as to what kind of a marriage we had. He gambled my drinking money, and I drank his gambling money. And that's a tense way to live, I can tell you that. But, I just couldn't, at this point, I couldn't stand another failure in my life. Because, see, I had never attained any goal that I'd set out for myself. I always just missed it by a little bit. But now this marriage was going to be successful. It was going to be successful. In order for that to be a good marriage, though, I had to get him away from all the gamblers, all the bookies up there. So we moved to Southern California, to suburbia, San Fernando Valley. And he found some bookies right up on the corner, and I found a drinking buddy right across the street, and the race was on again. And like I say, I couldn't stand for this marriage to be. I knew we were in trouble. I knew we were in trouble. In order to save this marriage, I said to myself, what I should do is get pregnant and have a baby, and then everything will be all right. And so I got pregnant, and now my whole idea of who and what I was going to be changed, because I was going to be perfect. I was going to be perfect. I was going to be like my neighbors. I was going to do my laundry on Mondays, hang it out in that San Fernando sun, and chit-chat over the back fence with those women. I was going to do all. I was going to be a perfect mother, housekeeper. I was going to be perfect in every way. And above all, this woman that I was now going to be did not drink. And so I went on the way. God, I can't. That's exactly how I felt. See? That's how I felt. So my obsession came out in other ways. I became a compulsive housekeeper. There's always one or two in the audience. I used to clean the corners with pins. And I had Q-tips in one of my pockets that I got the underside of things with. And I had a toothbrush in the other pocket that I got the lettering on the appliances with. And if the old man got out of bed in the middle of the night to go to the john, his bed was made before he got back. That's a tense way to live, too. You know, when that kid was born, it's a wonder I didn't boil him, because by that time I was washing the walls with Hexol, you know. Oh, God, it was... I tell you, I had created the perfect child in this world, and that nobody could get near him. Nobody. It was just madness, total madness. But then this went on for several months until I found out I was pregnant the second time. And I hadn't planned this one. You know how that goes? I hadn't planned this one. I was outraged. I knew that my husband was trying to keep me pregnant and barefoot out in the country, and I couldn't stand it. It was all his fault. And I finally said to myself, I mean, what the hell is the use? What is the use? I have been perfect. I have done everything perfectly, and this is the reward I get? I had this first child's whole life mapped out for him, what schools he was going to, what kind of clothes he was going to wear, what kind of friends I was going to allow him to have. And here comes this intruder. Of course, I always drank with two attitudes. One was, what's the use? And the other is, I'll show him. And so here it was, what's the use? So I decided to go across the street and have a couple of drinks, which I did. And I got away with it. Next day, I went over and had a couple more drinks and got away with that, too. Now, for you new people, I want you to listen to me closely. For someone like me, who's an alcoholic, to have a couple of drinks and get away with it, it's like a guy jumping out of the Empire State Building as he passes the 30th floor. He says, "So far, so good." And that's what happened. So far, so good. I already told you I wanted to be a perfect wife and mother and all this, but it was taken away from me. And this is where I went back. I decided to go back to my native habitat, which is a neighborhood bar. God, I love the bars, folks. I love to walk into that unreal atmosphere, that smoky atmosphere, where those guys tell me how sexy and desirable and smart I was. I used to love the smell from the men's room. I used to love, you know, I could walk in with a dollar and stay for 3 days. And you guys that were laughing were picking up my tab. Don't forget that. So it was that my husband took a dim view of my activities, and after my second son was born, he left me and came back, and left me and came back, always with the promise that he wouldn't gamble so much if I didn't drink so much. And of course, we were never able to keep our own promises to ourselves, never mind anybody else. And so it was that as a result of one of these joyous reunions, I got pregnant the third time. God, I was outraged womanhood. I tell you, I couldn't stand, I hated this man so badly I wanted to kill him. I mean, for real, I wanted to kill him. And now started my, you know, this is what I really wanted, though. What I really wanted to do was to be a playgirl, because I was terribly miscast in this role of mother and housewife. I now realized that I was terribly miscast. And so after my third child was born, I had the freedom to now do exactly what I wanted to do, and that is to be a playgirl, because my husband left me for what proved to be the last time. And now all those things that happened to alcoholic women started happening to me in rapid succession, and I was amazed that these things were happening to me. I remember coming to in an alley one cold gray dawn, sick and shaking and scared, and wondering what had happened to the great belle of Bush Street, and how did I find myself in that alley, you know, just thrown away like garbage. I remember being ordered out of that bar where I was once welcome, and the bartender saying, "Out, this is 10 o'clock in the morning." I had no recollection of having been there, because I was into a lot of blackout drinking. But I hope I never forget a Sunday morning such as we have this morning. Lurching down Ventura Boulevard, which is one of our main boulevards there, drunk and dirty. This is 10 o'clock in the morning, and I hadn't had a bath, and so I gave up bathing because I came to one morning with my nose this far from the water in the tub, and I knew right away that it was too dangerous for me to do that anymore. And so here I was lurching. In those days, I was splashing myself with huge amounts of Taboo perfume, because I tell you, mixed with that 86 proof sweat, it was something. But here I was on this Sunday morning lurching and falling down. My knees could never hold me up, and I was falling against buildings, and I came across this Catholic church where Mass was just letting out, and I fell flat on my face in front of the steps there, and I hope I never forget the look on those two little boys that were coming down the steps with their parents. And, you know, I was choking on my own disgust and biting back my tears and wishing to God that the earth would swallow me up, because the shame was just too much for me. It was too much for me, and I couldn't understand it. I couldn't understand how this was happening to me. And those are only some of the things that were happening to me on my way to Alcoholics Anonymous. My anger toward my husband was homicidal by this time. I really, in my madness, knew that I had to kill him in order to have any peace for myself. And so I was drinking behind closed doors and drawn shades, planning on how I was going to kill him, and I really mean that I was going to kill him had I had the opportunity. Instead of that, by the grace of God, for some reason or another, and I didn't realize how I did this or why, but I took the phone and called the North Hollywood Clubhouse, and a young man answered the phone. You know, it took me 2 years of sobriety to realize that where I got the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this woman was drinking across the street from me. She was a red-haired woman, and she was drinking a Coke. And, you know, I didn't like women at all. I hated women, and especially those who didn't drink. And so I apparently had gone over to her in my own inimitable fashion, asked her why the hell she wasn't drinking. And she said something to me about having found a better way to live. And she also said something to me, apparently, about Alcoholics Anonymous, because here I was talking to this young man on at the North Hollywood Clubhouse, and he sensed either my madness or my despair or whatever it was, but he said he'd be right out. Now, he broke the unwritten rule of Alcoholics Anonymous that men are not supposed to be calling on women, but I can tell you that God in his infinite wisdom sent the right man to call on me, because I was in no position to welcome a couple of Salvation Sioux. I can tell you that if this man had any romance in his soul on his way out to see me, that when I opened that front door, especially if he was downwind, you know, I often wonder if he thought, what an odor, I can't go through with it. Of course, that's followed by do not be discouraged, you know. And he came in, and I was standing there in my moo-moo, very functional drinking garment, I'll tell you. You know, you can sleep in it, you can make the run in it, you don't have to wear underwear. And if you throw up, it doesn't show too much. But that was gracious living, you understand. But I'm drinking vodka out of my cheese glass, standing there in all my regal splendor. And this man came in with the front cover of the grapevine, which was the Serenity Prayer. And I looked at it, and I thought that was a nice little prayer. But see, I wasn't alcoholic. I really didn't think I was alcoholic, because I had already established that fact by not drinking many, many times, knowing that I could take it or leave it. But here he was, and I finally just said, well, aren't you going to stop me from drinking? Because I still to this day don't remember what he said. All I know is he had this big AA smile on his face. And I kept drinking, and I said, aren't you going to stop me from drinking? He said, no, go ahead. Well, God, that got my attention. Because no one had ever told me that. And then he broke rule number two. He said, you know, you're an alcoholic. I thought, God, that's rather scientific sounding compared to what they have been calling me around here. I thought this man was brilliant, you know, brilliant. So anyway, I just, you know, he kept chattering away, and finally he said, would you like to go to a meeting? And I said, meeting? He said, yeah, there's a meeting out here in Chatsworth. And I said, well, you mean there are other people who will talk to me? And he said, sure. And I said, God, you know, long distance has been hanging up on me a long time now. Nobody's been talking to me. And he said, yeah, come on. So anyway, I went in and got my raincoat on, and I don't know why, but it wasn't raining, but I got it on anyway. And so I poured myself another drink, and I said, are you sure it's okay if I have this drink before we leave? And he said, yeah. And in typical alcoholic fashion, I said, to hell with it. And I left it there. And I've been allowed to stay sober since that very first night. And it was March the 29th, 1961. You know, you shouldn't applaud alcoholics. I heard John Larroquette, you know, the guy from Night Court, he was talking about his alcoholism on Phil Donahue's show one time, and I guess he's sober about 10 years now. He didn't mention AA, but he didn't mention he'd been sober for 10 years, but in the meantime, he was talking about where his alcoholism had taken him, and it was just really pretty bad story. And at the end of his discourse, some little housewife in the audience raised her hand, and he called on her. And she said, "Mr. Larroquette, I'd like to congratulate you for not drinking." And he said, "Lady, congratulating an alcoholic for not drinking is like congratulating a cowboy with hemorrhoids for not riding his horse." Yeah. I knew that would go especially well up here. I got into that car with this man, and none of you know how far it is from Encino to Chatsworth, except maybe Angie here. But I'm telling you, it was miles and miles and miles and miles and miles out. It kept getting darker and more desolate, and I thought, this guy's going to take me out and kill me. Well, I really didn't care, because I was a failure at suicide, too, so what, you know? I didn't care, really. And so we finally got out to this little church, and there was a little Sunday school building behind the church. And he told me to get out, and he parked the car, and he told me to go and look in the window. And I looked in the window, and I saw these people. They were all laughing, and they were clean, and they were hugging and kissing and rubbing up against, you know, like we do. And and I just knew, you know, I felt so dirty, and I just, you know how I felt. And I didn't want to go in there. He came up about that time, and I think he sensed that I was backing off, but he took me around to the front door, and he said, "Look in the front door." And I looked in the front door, and he took his hand and shoved me in. Now, that's promotion. That's not attraction, folks. So he introduced me to the woman who was to become my first sponsor, and she represented everything I hated in women. She was soft-spoken, spiritual, well-groomed, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And she spoon-fed my soul. I don't remember what was said that night at that first meeting that I went to, but I have never forgotten what I felt in that group, what I felt in that meeting and every meeting I have attended since then. I felt a power greater than myself. I felt a power of unconditional love such as I had never experienced in my life. I have never felt anything but that in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. That power is with us here this morning. Feel it. And that's what I took home with me that night when my sponsor dropped me off and told me she would pick me up the next morning at 8 o'clock and take me to a woman's meeting. God, I almost threw up. I couldn't tell her I hated women. And as she drove away, over her shoulder she said, "And by the way, please take a bath." And I thought, what do these people want from me? Don't they know who I am? But, you know, the next morning I was as sick as I've ever been in my life, I think. I was sweating and I was shaking and I was trying, it took me all day long to get ready for that woman's meeting that night. And, you know, I was trying to put lipstick on, it was going up my nose, and I was shaking so badly. And that half a bottle of vodka was on that sink, and I wanted a drink, just a drink, you know, not to get drunk, but just to get well. But I remember someone at that meeting saying, "Any damn fool can stay sober for 24 hours. And I didn't want them to think I was a damn fool. And so I just sweated it out, and I got to that meeting that night, and God, I tell you, I really didn't belong there. This was a very elegant group of people. These gals all had every hair in place, and they were dressed beautifully, and especially the gal that was leading that meeting. God, she was the most elegant gal I ever saw. She was sitting on platinum ovaries, this gal. I mean, she was elegant now. She was elegant. And I knew that I did not belong there. I knew I didn't belong there. But I think when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, because the next gal that got up and talked in my native tongue, which was profanity. And you can bet I made a beeline for her right after the meeting. Needless to say, I really didn't think I was alcoholic, but, you know, I love what I felt here, and I wanted all of it. And so I started going 10 meetings a week. God, I was just, I was just in love with what I felt here and what I the laughter and the hugging and the kissing and the rubbing up against. You know, I loved all of that. And I went to all these meetings, and like I say, I was going to 10 meetings a week. And my husband found out that I was going to AA, and he started calling me and threatening to take, in his own madness, threatening to take my children, threatening to kill me. And this went on, and I couldn't tell my sponsor what was happening to me. I was really dearly hanging on for dear life and not drinking, but I was just so enraged with this man. And finally, I had to call her and tell her that he was driving me crazy, and he kept this homicide stirred up in me. And I said, I don't know what to do. And she said, well, hang up. It never occurred to me. But they talked to me in very simple terms in those days. But then, see, hang up. You know, I come from where you get even. I don't hang up on anybody. But the next time he called, I just picked up the phone and I said, I'm sorry, but you're upsetting my serenity. Hung up real fast. As I say, I was in this group. There was a group of hard-nosed old-timers. God, I have such a respect for those hard-nosed old-timers that, you know, they didn't pat me on my head and tell me how wonderful I was doing. They put their foot in my behind, and it took a major operation to get it out. That's what happened. And I thank God for those people, because they cared more about my survival than they did my approval. And I think that's very important in our game of sobriety here. In this woman's meeting, I again received a phone call about three months after this first incident, and again he threatened to kill me, and again he threatened to take the children. And I, in my heart, knew that he could take those children, because I was an unfit mother. And I went screaming to the woman's meeting that night, and I was just crying and screaming and saying, I can't stand it any longer. I got to kill this guy. And you know what that elegant lady said to me? She said, pray for the son of a bitch. And you know, that's the last thing I wanted to do, for God's sake. Of course, my whole program is the last thing I want to do, starting with step one. Everything's been the last thing I wanted to do. So that night, at the conclusion of the meeting, I started to pray for him. And I didn't mean a damn word of it, I'll tell you that. I didn't mean a word of it, but I prayed for him anyway, because they told me to. And the strange thing is, I kept praying for him, and it didn't change him a bit. It didn't change him a bit. What happened was, it changed me. It took all that hatred right off of my shoulders, and it gave me an understanding of the sickness, and it gave me some compassion for him. And it was then that I was ordered to make my amends to him, which I didn't want to do. But I was ordered to do that, and I was privileged because of those people. I was privileged to make my amends to him just 2 weeks before he died of a heart attack. And now I was left with three little kids. The restaurant that we had been running for 12 years was very deeply in debt because of his gambling, and I guess my drinking, but mostly. And I thought, you know, now that he died, we don't owe the IRS. The hell we didn't. We had a big bill with the IRS, and I went to my home group with the idea that now I'm off the hook, you know, everything's wiped clean. And they said, no, you have to make your financial amends to all the purveyors and the IRS and everybody. And so what happened was, I was stuck running that restaurant. I decided that I was going to get that restaurant paid off, the bills paid off, as fast as I could with the help of the people that I knew. And so my sons and I lived on the Social Security that my husband had left for us. And I paid off all those bills. In the meantime, they decided that we needed a meeting in that restaurant. And we started a meeting. And before you know it, we had about two or three meetings a week going there. At the end of the year, all the bills were paid off. And the old-timers at that end of the valley decided we needed a clubhouse out there. So we got permission from the landlord to turn the restaurant into a clubhouse. And that clubhouse is still in existence. It is the sickest damn clubhouse in the world, I can tell you that. The reason for that is that we accepted all the rejects from all the other clubs, and but a lot of sobriety has come out of it. It's called the Nest. I don't know whether anybody's heard of it. Maybe Katrina or her husband. Maybe, see, he's nodding his head. Sick place, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, I was in charge of the coffee bar, and I became queen of the AA San Fernando Valley. I was running everybody's life. Everybody's life, because I was now queen of AA in the San Fernando Valley. And I loved that job, and while I was on that job, you know, across a crowded room, I saw him. Angie remembers this. And you know, our eyes locked. You know how it is. And we fell madly, passionately in love. And we would have gotten married, except he already was. And we know how that ended. They don't do that up here, do they? Anyway, along came a spiritual giant, and I married him. Don't laugh. Biggest mistake I ever made. Biggest mistake I ever made. But how can you admit you made a big mistake when you're queen of the AA Valley? How can you do that? You don't. You try to make it work somehow, some way. And people were betting that I was either going to get drunk or go crazy. And I was trying to be, you know, a good AA and keep it all within myself. And it was, thank God, Elsa C., who got me to talk about it and gave me permission to divorce him. And so here I was now, still no money. So I got a job in a hospital kitchen, and I was supposed to be learning to be a diet aide there. But most of the time, the dishwasher didn't show up, so I got to wash pots and pans and clean employees' toilets. And I hated that job. In the meantime, I forgot to tell you that my first sponsor was transferred up to San Francisco, so I had been following this little guy around, listening to him talk. Best teacher we have, I think. I asked him to be my sponsor. A lot of people here know him. His name is Clancy. And he is a dictator, and he's a fascist, and he's my hero. I'll tell you, he is my hero. He is the only one I know in all of AA that sponsors four people that have 30 years sobriety. We have our class of 61 that meets all the time. And he's my hero. Anyway, I used to call him up and whine and say, I can't stand this job. Clancy, don't they know who I am? My God, it's a menial damn job. And he'd say, you got another job to go to, kid? And I'd say, no. He's, well, when God's ready to move you, he'll move you. And I just keep trucking. And God, I can stand it. Stand it. Thank God he made me take steps that, you know, that were meant for my survival. He forced me into taking those steps. And so it was that I went along with this job for a while, and came the day when I found out why God put me in that menial job. That was the only way that my values could have been changed. The only way to put me in a menial job like that, to know, to recognize the spiritual gifts that we're talking about here in Alcoholics Anonymous. They call this a spiritual program because we are talking here of the things of the Spirit. And I had finally been introduced to a feeling of gratitude that I had never had in my whole life when my oldest son made first string varsity in high school and invited me to his first game. And I can tell you that I was so overwhelmed with this feeling of gratitude that here I was, a fallen down drunk, being invited to participate in my son's, maybe the most important day of his life up to that time. And it was, to me, a miraculous thing that I was able to walk into that stadium with my head up to see it could have been so different. It could have been so different. And I walked into that stadium and I sat clear in the end zone. And I sat there watching those kids warm up out on the field. And I looked at him and I thought, my God, I could have missed it all if it wasn't for those people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. And I broke down and cried when they called his name as a starting player. such gratitude I had never experienced with all the things that I had. And my second son followed in his footsteps, and I was out there every Friday crying. Anything worth doing is worth doing to excess. And those two kids have, you know, they have grown up to be such fine gentlemen. They're both very successful in the insurance business. And as a matter of fact, my second son and his wife that he married after they'd been going together since junior high school, and they gave me three grandsons, they decided a few years ago, to change their religion, and they became born-again Christians. And I was invited to their wedding, and I went out to their wedding. And after the wedding, we went out to their home, which is a very beautiful home. He's very successful. And those Christian people were walking around sipping champagne. And I was sitting next to a woman sipping champagne. And she'd put it up to her mouth and put it down again. And I tell you, I wanted to take that glass and shove it in her mouth and say, God damn it, drink it. That's what makes me an alcoholic, see? And then my son come and knelt down by me and put his hand on my arm, and he says, Mother, I got to talk to you seriously. And I said, what's that? And he said, Mother, you got to be saved. I said, Jesus, you don't know what it is to be saved. I guess he got a flash of Mother flaked out on the couch, you know, and his eyes white, he said, you're right. And my oldest son has given me a grandson and a granddaughter. The granddaughter is going to be in the Nutcracker this year down there, which is a big thrill for all of us. And her little brother is a candidate for San Quentin. And but you know, we've had a lot of laughs this morning, and thank God. But you know, I have found out for people like us, we're either laughing or crying, and everything else in between is dull. Right? So I have to share my pain with you. But I have to share. That's why I came here. My daughter, at the age of 14, picked up her first drink, and another alcoholic was born. And I was to know the sleepless nights, the running after her up and down the coast, not knowing where she was or if she was. And believe me, I did not know that she was an alcoholic. I thought she was going through a phase, that part of denial that we go through once in a while. And then came the day when she was in a crisis of her own and said that she wanted to get out of this whole thing, and it was precisely at that time that God decided to move me out of the hospital, because the bank on the corner wanted to buy my house, and with that money I could quit and take my daughter to Honolulu, over to Hawaii, get her away from all those bad people. Now, I should have known better, but you know, hope springs eternal in the heart of a mother. And we went over to Honolulu. And I got a job in managing a woman's step house at St. Francis Hospital over there. And that's where I learned to love women. And my daughter did well for a few months, but she finally got into deep drugs over there. She got into deep trouble. And because we did not have an Al-Anon meeting in the house at that time, we started an Al-Anon meeting, and that's when I joined Al-Anon. And thank God for those women, because they gave me the strength and the courage to do the last thing I ever wanted to do. And that was to take my daughter down to the Honolulu airport while she cried and screamed for another chance. Take her down there and put her on the plane and tell her to get the hell out of my life, because I knew I was killing her and she was killing me. And I walked away from her as fast as I could, because I knew that if I stood there long enough, she could talk herself into coming back. But I walked away, and those Al-Anon women and the AA women were waiting for me to give me comfort and support. A couple of months after that, My supervisor gave me a leave of absence, a week. And, of course, the one thing I wanted to do was to go up to the San Fernando Valley and get some of that industrial strength AA, because my cup was getting empty. And I wanted to visit all my home groups. And I walked into the Shoop Sunday night group, and my daughter was reading chapter 5 from the podium. And I wish I could tell you that from that day to this, she has never had any more drugs or alcohol. Unfortunately, I have no such report to make. Because after 2 years of sobriety on our program, she made a decision to turn her life and her will over to the care of cocaine. And the nightmare began. A few years ago, it was necessary for me to legally take away her 18-month-old son. And since neither one of my boys could take this child at that time, it was impossible. The doors were all closed. My then boss gave me a month, to get this whole mess straightened out. I knew that I was going to have to give him up. And I couldn't stand that idea. I could not stand the idea that I had to send him out into the world and never know what happened to him again. You see, in that 1 month, I bonded with him. And I thought I would never see the fear go out of that little kid's eyes. And I was crying inside. And I stayed home with him for that month. And the AA people were calling me and supporting me, but I couldn't hear what you were saying. I couldn't hear, and the pain was so great that I really, the thought of suicide even entered my head, because I could not let this kid go to a foster home. I couldn't stand that idea. But see, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Because through my born-again daughter-in-law, she had a Christian friend. She had Christian friends up in Sacramento in the military who had been married for 10 years, a good marriage, and were not able to have children of their own. And they wanted this child. And I thought at least, there's some cord where I could trace it. I'd find out how he was doing and how he was. At least I'm not throwing him out into the world. And so they eagerly took this child and gave him the love and everything this kid needed. And I want to tell you something that I don't want you to forget, that God always compensates. Because this woman has written to me regularly, has sent me pictures regularly. See, I didn't even ask for that. But she has kept in touch with me. And God has compensated her also, because she got pregnant and had a little girl. Gave him a little sister. And last year, the people of St. Louis asked me to go and speak at their banquet. And they almost came through the phone, because, see, that's where the kid is. And they didn't know that. God compensated again. And I was to walk into that home where this little kid is being raised. And it was the home where you walk into it, and the love embraces you as you walk into that front door. The peace and the serenity. And we went out to dinner. And after dinner, we went to the mall. I bought him every goddamn thing he wanted. It's like Angie says, I may not be a good mother, but I am a wonderful grandmother. This is wonderful. And so it is that he's safe, he's well, he has another little sister too. And I was just there 3 weeks ago again, because they asked me, St. Louis asked me to come back again, and I saw him again, and he showed me a new mall. And I got a letter from him and said, they're looking for some more malls, and he wants... and they found a new ice cream place too. And so it is that he's safe. He's well. As for my daughter, the only time I know where she is when she's in jail. Otherwise, she's in the middle of the dope area in Santa Ana, doing what she has to do on the street corners for what she has to get. And I don't have to be specific about that. Up an alley with a needle in her arm. And so it is that my life is one day at a time, a step at a time, and a prayer at a time. And I know that at the conclusion of these meetings all over the world, that over 2 million recovered alcoholics are praying for her and people like her. And I'm a living example as possible to stay sober with a broken heart. Everything I have, everything I hold dear, I got from the people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. But most of all, for teaching me to walk in the dignity of sobriety, thank you from the bottom of my heart.